मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्काररचितानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्री न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मेय चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप
Hello, good afternoon at my time, and good morning to those of you who are on another continent, and good evening for those of you who are east of me in the United States and other parts of the Western Hemisphere, so of the American aspect of the Western Hemisphere. This is our Q&A session. It's our second and our final Q&A session for this particular redaction of the Shiva Sutras. And I want to reiterate that we are going to do a second helping of the Shiva Sutras. It's going to be in November. And we'll be essentially working with Book 3, which is the book of this text that actually most directly relates to the kind of practices that help us, let's say, work with our ordinary mind and body states, especially with our normal states of prana, of pranic energy, to transform ourselves from where we mostly are into the more energy-based and more transcendent-based states. So, and the Book 3 of the Shiva Sutras also deals with a lot of kind of nitty-gritty yogic esoterica, you know, such as what actually happens as we kind of move through the tattvas, move through the different stages of consciousness, the various siddhis, the supernatural powers that come to us, which is always a tremendously interesting topic, and, you know, just the way in which our ways of moving through the world get affected in the course of this sadhana. So it will be, let's say, extremely relatable, which is not to say that the books we've been studying are not relatable, but I would say relatable in a way that relates more specifically to what we actually do when we practice yoga and meditation in the contemporary world. I hope you'll all be there. And now I'm hoping that you're going to bring a bunch of very juicy questions, and that doesn't mean your question has to be super interesting. I'm also very happy to accept questions that you may think are boring or routine, because as I think we are discovering, really no question is boring and routine when it relates to the transformation of consciousness. First, let me ask if there's anyone on the live call who has a question. And if you're on the webcast, you can type your question into the chat box and Deb will read it for us.
We do. We have someone in Connecticut that's raised their hand. So
okay.
You are unmuted.
Thank you, Deb. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Hi. I have three questions. I'm not going to be too greedy, though. They might be quick ones. Shall I put all three out?
Yeah, just go for it. Start with one.
Okay. One is, and I'm sure they'll be very brief, actually. So one is, you mentioned it in passing in this past, in number 5, the sacredness of the body. And I just would love to hear you, you know, elaborate on how you experience that and how that is so for you and according to Tantra.
This is not a brief question, but
okay.
But I will answer it as briefly as possible.
Okay.
In the Tantras, and it's actually throughout the Eastern traditions, there's this understanding that everything that exists in the cosmos exists in the human body. It's actually one of the sutras in Book 3, as here, so elsewhere. What is not here is nowhere, which is a pretty remarkable statement. In other words, what we discover as we go deeper and deeper into meditation and as our so-called ordinary consciousness begins to look into itself and recognize some of the really extraordinary gifts and powers and understandings that we hold, we start to realize that, you know, as the texts say, there the sun is in the body, the moon is in the body, all deities are in the body, all languages are in the body. Everything that can be found in the so-called external world can be experienced in ourselves. And by body, of course, they don't mean just the physical body, because obviously the physical body we're actually able to experience the physical body only in certain states. You know, when you're in the waking state, you're most of the time, are at least aware that we have physical bodies. When we go into the dream state, the physical body that we're used to dissolves, and we are inside a dream body, which is very much connected to the subtle body, to the subtle energy body, but which is really much more of a mental body than our, you know, than our physical body is. And causal body, which is subtler than the subtle body, actually contains the blueprint for not only our own lives, and that's a big topic that we probably don't have time to go into right now, but it also contains the blueprint for the wholeness. So in many Eastern traditions, the causal body, which is the body that ordinarily we experience in deep sleep, as well as in deep meditation, the causal body actually holds the source code, you know, to use computer language, for everything that exists in the manifest world, because the causal body is the place, because remember, as individuals, we are holograms of the absolute. So that what that means is that all the levels of consciousness, all the tattvas, all the principles of existence are inside our body, not just the physical body, but these subtler bodies that we enter in meditation. Now, in my experience of the physical body, which, you know, like many of you, I suspect, I had to become a deep meditator in order to really start to experience, because like many modern people, I spent most of the first 25 years of my life completely out of touch with my physical body, sort of living in my mind and imagination. But the cells of the physical body, and you know this if you've ever seen a picture of what a cell looks like under a microscope, you see that what's actually inside a cell is this moving, undulating mass of not just electrons and protons, but, you know, actually of creative energy. And someone just sent me a computer simulation of what that looks like, which I'm going to send out to the, we're going to put up on the student site. So every cell of your body, and this is what the tantras say about it, and it's pretty much my experience, every cell of your body, if you can tune into it, that is to say, if you can tune in to the flesh of your arm and the flesh of your muscles, you discover that behind, within the physical cellular structure is a portal into the subtle and ultimately into the divine nature of the subtle. So the physical body, which is sometimes described as the temple, you know, the temple of the soul, in fact, the physical body itself contains innumerable portals into the divine realm. So that's just part of what we mean when we say that the body is sacred.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's always so inspiring when we do the meditations, you know, and get in touch with that, you know, like breathing in the golden particles around us. And I have that tactile sense, but I like having sort of the intellectual kind of...
Yes, the explanation helps.
Yeah,
and the explanations are inspiring. So I'm just going to ask you, hold your questions. We'll see if someone else has a hand raised.
Sure.
And if not, we'll come back to your other questions.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. So hold on. And is there, Deb, is there anyone else who is?
I've actually got a question from the webcast. Paul asks, how is the best way to deal with extreme anger that flares up during meditation?
Well, first of all, anybody recognize that? I certainly do. First of all, it's really important to understand that meditation, I think we can't hear this enough, because most of us, even when we, quote, know better, tend to believe that meditation is only appropriate when our consciousness is expanding and we feel mellow and peaceful. But actually, one of the purposes of meditation is to give us the opportunity to sit tight, to sit quietly, and hold the stuff that's stuck in our unconscious, that's stuck in our energy body, that's also stuck in our physical body, because as that fantastic book that I think many of you know by Bessel van der, what is his name? I completely recommend it. Bessel van der Kolk. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. And it is about how anger, grief, all kinds of trauma that are not processed subtly get stuck in the body and, of course, cause every form of disease. So when you meditate, you often what you're doing, not that you chose to do it, but it's going to happen anyway, is processing those stuck energies, one of the biggies, is anger. I do feel that the three big, let's call them difficult emotions, though, as most of you know, they're not entirely difficult. They're full of wisdom if we understand how to hold them. But anger, sadness, and fear are probably the three most primal emotions that most of us experience. And I'm sure there's nobody on this call who hasn't had an experience of anger, sadness, or fear arising in meditation, sometimes so intensely that you just want to open your eyes and sit up. So I have found that there are several ways to process anger in meditation. The sort of ultimate way, the subtlest and most actually transformative way, is to find the energy inside the anger, to feel it as an energy, to let go of the story, as probably all of you know, because it's something that many, many teachers will tell you, to stop paying attention to the story and to feel into the energetic experience of anger, find where it is in your body, and embrace it with your awareness. In other words, and I do it by actually imagining space around that part of my body and just holding the anger and the space. So if you can do that, if you can bear it, you know, sometimes it's too hot to hold, so to speak. But this method, this practice, will over time actually devour, actually is the term I was looking for, it will devour the particles of anger in your body. There's a sutra that I'm hoping to get to tomorrow in the Shiva Sutras. It's book 2, Sutra 9, Jnanam Anam. It means knowledge is food. And what that means is that when awareness opens in its fullness, it literally eats your limiting thoughts, and it also eats your emotional diseases. So, and meditation is simply the way we give ourselves for that process to happen. You don't have to, in fact, you don't really have to do anything except sit with it, be with it, hold it, be present with the anger, feel it in your body and hold space around it, and just keep returning to the space. The trauma therapist Peter Levine has this phrase, which he calls it toggling, where you let yourself feel the traumatic feeling, and he's talking about serious trauma, which may not be what you're talking about, but you know, anger is related to held trauma. You know, you feel it as much as you can handle feeling it, and then you move off it, and you kind of play the edge between the felt sense of your anger or your grief and the space around it. And, you know, kind of opening into the space and then coming back to the feeling of anger. It's like, it is actually, somebody I know used this phrase, it's like holding hot coals in one of those old-fashioned warming pans. You just let awareness hold it. The other thing you can do with anger is say the mantra into it. And if you have a relationship with your mantra and keep injecting it into the felt sense of anger, and here you have to work with the feelings, though the mantra can also dispel particles of the story as well. But, you know, the power in the mantra, the grace in the mantra, will flow into the energy of anger and begin to dispel it. And dispel it, by the way, not only temporarily, it will dispel the layer of it that is up for you now. And, of course, the truth is that most of us have many layers of anger, grief, fear, etc. So these emotions will come up again and again. But what happens as you learn to sit with them is that they stop being so scary. They stop feeling so monstrous. You stop feeling like they're insoluble problems. And you begin to recognize that you can be creative with these emotions. So I've just offered you two ways of being creative with them, and thank you for the question. So, Deb, is there anyone else who'd like to speak before we go?
Just want to remind everybody, if you have a question, just to hit star 2.
Okay, thank you. So we'll go back to your other two questions.
Thank you. Am I still unmuted?
No, you're still unmuted.
Okay.
So
One, I was just getting ready to put in the webcast. It can be more general, but I'll start, if there's time, I'll ask that. But I'll start while I have you live. It's more of a personal question that I'm curious, if I were to, you know, I think the more I'm learning about, like, the different mantras, the power, and the different deities, and I know we are in the Shiva Sutras right now, but if on an ongoing basis, I'm curious how I would determine for myself, say, which deity and which mantra I might choose depending on where I am and what I want to amplify in my life, because there is a, like, once this course is over, kind of looking for that ongoing practice. If I have, right now my desires are somewhat twofold in that I definitely want to amplify abundance that obviously directly correlates with Lakshmi. And yet I also feel really drawn to the frequency of Lalita, and especially more of that, has more of that sensual erotic quality as well, that this is vulnerable to share, but I've been single for a long time. So there's a desire to connect, to have a practice that's helping, that has that juiciness and has that kind of embodied aliveness to it as well. And maybe Lakshmi can too, but, and maybe I'm looking at it too literally as far as picking the qualities and then picking the goddess. But I really am wanting to devote myself to some extended practice time, and just curious what you might suggest for how I might pick or choose, or
I get your question, and I would say you answered it. My suggestion, my hit from listening to you is that you do very well practicing with Lakshmi mantras and doing Lakshmi practice. Lakshmi and Lalita have a lot in common. They're from different corners of the Indian religious tradition, in that Lakshmi is considered to be the consort of Vishnu, who is the male deity who sustains and nourishes the worlds, whereas Lalita is a Shaiva goddess. So she has, a more unconventional quality to her, in my experience. But they're both goddesses of Shri, both goddesses of abundance. They're both goddesses of love. They're both, my experience of both of these goddesses, both of whom I love very much, is that really it if what you are looking for is the joy and juice of life, which I would say is the true abundance that, you know, that we all crave, you'll do very, very well practicing with Lakshmi. And one of the advantages of Lakshmi practice is that because she's a more popular, a more mainstream form of goddess, you'll find a lot of resources for getting in touch with her. And there are several different Lakshmi mantras. There's a book, I don't know if you're aware of it, by Constantina Rhodes called Invoking Lakshmi. It has a really wonderful introduction about Lakshmi and about how Lakshmi is understood in the Vedic tradition of India as well as in the Tantric tradition. And she's translated a number of hymns and invocations and mantras. So I would suggest that you practice with Lakshmi and just be aware that Lakshmi is not just this beautiful iconic figure that you see in paintings. Lakshmi is your own inner sense of abundance, your own inner sense of harmony, and she is actually the go-to goddess in the Orthodox Hindu tradition, but in many, many more contemporary traditions as well. She is the go-to goddess for children, for getting pregnant, and definitely the go-to goddess for finding a partner. So I would say that you'll do well with invoking her, and also whatever the external effects are, your Lakshmi practice will open your heart, which I think for all of us is kind of the greatest thing that can happen through goddess practice.
Thank you. And then when would I know that I'm sort of complete and it's time to move on to some other focus?
I wouldn't ask that question. It's premature to ask that question.
Okay.
I mean, of course, you can ask the question. You can ask any question. But I would say that when you're beginning a practice, just feel, first of all, that the practice is so, and this is true of any one of the practices that involve a deity like Lakshmi, who is not just, she's not just a figurehead goddess. She's one of the names, one of the ways in which Lakshmi is invoked in one of her Gayatris goes, Mahalakshmiye cha vidmahe sarva shakti cha dhimahi tano devi prachodayat, which means let us meditate on Lakshmi, let the she who is all shaktis, all powers, all forms of the divine feminine illumine my intellect. So understand this about her. She's not a minor figure who only works in certain areas of life. She can encompass everything. You can do Lakshmi practice for the rest of your life. And you'll know when it's time to move on, because what will happen is that you'll, what I want to say is you'll stop being interested, but sometimes we stop being interested because some resistance has come up. So the fact that you stop being interested is not necessarily a reason to stop doing the practice. But if the juiciness of the practice starts to fall away and that loss of juiciness happens over a period of time, a period of, say, 3 to 6 months, then it often means that practice is no longer, I won't say working, but is no longer answering the longings that you're holding in your being at this particular time. But I would say, Lakshmi is endless. there's really no end to her gifts. So unless you feel drawn to a more formless kind of practice, which does often happen, even then, if you're meditating on pure awareness, even then you'll probably find that the rasa in Lakshmi mantras is going to be powerful for you. The Lakshmi Bij mantra, the one that Constantina uses and that I also use, and there are a number of Lakshmi mantras, as I've said, but the mantra Om Shrim Hrim is you know, a short meditative succession of seed mantras that invokes Lakshmi. And you can also practice it as Om Shrim Hrim Mahalakshmiye Namaha, or in other configurations. And I would suggest that you add a chanting practice, the one that I often use and that many people in this Sangam use is called the Ashtalakshmi Stotram. It's 8 stanzas in praise of Goddess Lakshmi. There's many, many versions of it on YouTube. So you can find the tune and probably the lyrics there.
Hmm. Wonderful. And then with the silent mantra, would you do one full round on inhale and another full round on exhale, or just like silent on the out-breath, let it permeate the body, kind of like we do in some of the other meditations?
You can play with it.
Okay.
If you're coordinating the mantra with the breath, it actually is quite skillful to simply inhale with the mantra and let the exhalation be free. So that and the idea behind that is that when you don't attach the mantra to the exhalation, it actually gives your prana and with it your consciousness room to expand.
Mm.
So play with it. You know, you'll start to get signals and messages if you pay attention to them that will let you know. The mantra will start to, it might change, morph, you know, turn into a different mantra, appear in some different parts of your body. This is the joy of mantra practice, is that it's not a fixed thing. It's highly mm-hmm. dynamic. And the, you know, the best results, I don't even want to use the word results, the best day-to-day, moment-to-moment experience of mantra practice is when you just let yourself be in the felt sense of the syllables in the moment and let it do what it wants to do, which is expand your consciousness and fill your body with its sweetness. So thank you. I don't know.
Thank you.
Who is this? Your name is showing up as a man's name, which I don't think from the sound of your voice you are.
Is it okay
maybe
if I
husband.
Stay anonymous? Is it okay
of
if
course,
I stay anonymous? Okay.
Absolutely. No problem.
Thank you.
So you're so welcome. So, Deb, who else have we got?
We've got someone in Oklahoma.
Hi, Sally.
How are you, sweetie?
I'm good.
Good.
Again, I raised my hand. Thank you. I raised my hand, but now I'm feeling timid and shy, kind of like maybe Lakshmi. maybe her energy came in really big. On the listserv, you've talked about, when you step into your life bigger, more, then it can get intense and big. And I've always lived quite small and had my light like under a bushel. And so, you know, I'm thinking you already mentioned the third book of the sutras might be helpful for me with this question. but when life gets really big and really intense and there's just a whole lot showing up, and it's like a lot of it is really, really good. It's just so much is required, and I am kind of in overwhelm from it. And I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about even being with that, managing it. As you were talking to the last person, I thought, well, maybe I need to add some goddess mantra to the Shiva stuff. But if you could say something, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I would suggest experimenting with a goddess mantra. And I would, if you want to do that, practice with a mantra of one of the Soumya goddesses, that is the mild goddesses, of which Lakshmi is one. Lakshmi is the Shakti. But she's a gentler form of Shakti than, say, Kali or Durga or even Lalita. So you might try practicing with a beach mantra like Om Hrim, Om Shrim Hrim, and just see if you find it soothing. I actually have the opposite experience when I'm meditating with goddesses. The Shakti often feels bigger and more intense than it does when I'm meditating with Shiva. But
it always has for me. But
that's
I
just me.
Yeah, it always has. But right now, it's like, I don't know. I've always said I live in Oklahoma where tornadoes are. And I have to say, most of this is things I've prayed and wanted for 30 years that are happening. But, it's got me in the skin. Yeah.
Well, you know, as you know, all the people who study stress say that getting what you want is just as stressful in its own way as losing what you want. So, you know, and sometimes more so because we feel like we have to step up to it. You know, whereas when you've had a loss, you kind of, if you're fortunate, you know, you can cocoon yourself for a while. Some people don't get to do that, but when there is abundance, stimulation comes to you from all sides. And I would say, again, speaking from my own experience, this is a good time to hone your no. In other words, just decide, okay, I can't do all this, I can't hold all this, I can't manage all this. So let what matters most, what can I manage? And let the rest go. And I would, at least for now, I would also say, we're in a time of maximum upheaval, as I think we all know. I mean, it's not just our personal field, it's the whole field everywhere.
Yes,
as
ma'am.
It's just roiling. So, you know, given that you're very energetically sensitive, it's very possible that you're just opening to the tuning to the upheaval in the field. And, you know, for that, just really strengthening your energetic boundaries helps and breathing it out. You know, it's just like releasing it without a feeling of aversion. And I guess the other thing I want to say to you is that it is okay. It's, you know, you're strong enough energetically to handle all this, even though I know you probably don't think so. And often we have the habit of thinking of ourselves as not being strong enough to handle big energies. But you are. And, you know, so just let yourself open a little bit and then close back up, or bring your boundaries in and then open a little more. I think it's going to be fine.
Yeah, thank you. That one brought tears. All of it is perfect. Thank you, Sally.
You're so welcome, and thank you. So, Deb.
We have another question from the webcast. So Paul says, if you're using I'm as your Lakshmi mantra, should you use I'm Namaha or Shri I'm Namaha?
Well, I'm, if we're going to be technical about it, I'm is more of a Saraswati mantra than actually a mantra for Lakshmi. I also want to say a little trick that I learned from one of my teachers. When you say a Lakshmi mantra or a Lakshmi mantra, the energetic resonance is of this aspect of the goddess called a Lakshmi, meaning no Lakshmi. In other words, a Lakshmi is one of the names for the goddess of poverty. So you just don't want to say a Lakshmi mantra, which is why I'm avoiding it. Blessings to the goddess of renunciation and poverty, who has her own power. But in terms of choosing a mantra that invokes Lakshmi, and if Aim is your root mantra, I would add Shreem to it. So you might just say Om Aim. Here's what I would do. I would practice it as Om Aim Hrim Shreem. So with this sequence of three seed syllables, which invoke the goddess Lalita, actually, but containing within herself the Lakshmi power. And that way you're invoking the power of creativity, the power of Aim, the power of the spread of the manifest universe, which is the power in Harim, and the power of Shirim, which is the power of auspiciousness and beauty, which is specifically connected with Lakshmi. And if you're practicing with Om, you can also do Om Aim Shirim Harim. But if you're doing Shirim Harim, I would suggest that you do Om Shirim Harim. And I hope that's not too confusing. So if you want to practice with Aim, add Harim Shirim to it. If you want to practice with Shirim Harim, I would drop the Aim.
Okay. So I have another question from the webcast. They say, you mentioned last week in a response that in the way that our lives may unfold or not, Shakti is always showing us where we are not yet free. Can you say any more about how I can be more attuned to recognize how and where this is showing up and be able to reflect, process, and work with this phenomenon more consciously?
Yes, sure. So when I said Shakti's always showing us where we're not free, the way she does this is by how we react to challenges. So obviously in everybody's life, there are things that kind of suck, you know, that are not what we wish for ourselves. And there are also going to be people that are problematic for us, unpleasant incidents, you know, stuff, forest fires, smoke in the field, that's what happens out here in the West in summertime. So these are challenges. These are part of what life throws up because life is filled with changes and challenges. Where you can find your hooks is by looking at your reactions. And, you know, obviously when something difficult happens, all of us have a kind of a recoil, you know, where you just go, oh, no, it's not what I want. So I wouldn't call that an indicator that this is a place to look for your particular flavor of bondage. But when your resistance to your life circumstances stays for a long time, feels overwhelming, triggers deep samskaras, deep forms of suffering and wounding, this is where to look. So let me see if I can give you an example. Okay, I have an issue that I've had most of my life, or since early girlhood, you know, of a feeling that certain people don't like me. And I've learned over the years that this is not necessarily true, but the samskara is there. So every time I have this feeling of, oh, so-and-so doesn't like me, I've learned to look at that story and the feelings of it. And say thank you to the Shakti for displaying for me a circumstance in which I get to look at this this particular form of binding energy, and to open to dispel it, to make space around it, to remember love, to ask myself, is this true? Is it really true? In other words, just to work with it. But it's always really good to start, which is what I think I said, to start by actually formally saying thank you. In other words, welcoming the energy that is that's causing contraction, because it really is a mirror of the places in your psyche that need to be liberated, that need to be untied. This is not something that you have to think about, and this is really important. You don't have to go, okay, where are the places in my being that I'm not free, let me bring them up and analyze them and work with them, which is, you know, how most of us in the West tend to think we should proceed with our less than open experience. It's really in the moment that you work with it. So when something comes up and you feel contracted, that's the place and the time to work. And, you know, you do it with the feeling this is happening in the moment. It's happening because of certain circumstances, but it's pointing me to something deeper, and it always is. That anytime you feel uncomfortable, you're feeling uncomfortable because it's bringing up something from your past. And this is something you can pretty much count on, whether it's something from your past that you remember the source of or not. It's never because of what's happening in the moment. And I accept, I mean, obviously if you're in the middle of something that is causing physical harm, then that's a different story. But when you're talking about things that bring up psychological issues that you sense are bigger or deeper than the circumstances, that's where to look. I'm not suggesting that when you see injustice that you should be completely neutral about it. But it's also very interesting, because, you know, speaking of the justice-injustice paradox, many of us who have a strong sense of justice, who are very disturbed by injustice, I'm one of them, very often it actually goes back to early childhood wounding, you know, that it's our early childhood wounding which makes it such a big deal and creates so much charge. So it's in the charge that you want to look, not in the circumstances. So thank you for that question. This is not original with me, but a teacher that I like often says that when we have personal difficulties, and again, I really do believe that there are certain social conditions that we are supposed to try and change, and that's true of many of our personal circumstances, but very often the charge that we have around certain feelings and certain personal circumstances will first cause tremendous suffering that is not always necessary. Pain is part of life. Suffering is very often not necessary. In other words, we can experience the pain. We can notice the pain. We can do what we can to alleviate it. But that feeling of deep suffering asks us to first welcome it, you know, to not make it bad, to recognize that it's showing us something, and then to just ask, okay, what is it that I'm being shown, and how can I practice with this? Recognizing that Shakti, this is the place where I'm quoting this other teacher, Shakti, out of her profound compassion, shows us over and over again what we need to work on, both as individuals and as a society, so that we can transform it. And so the experience of suffering is an invitation to transformation. But again, in my experience, before you start trying to transform a situation outwardly, it's very important to recognize, welcome, and as best you can work with your inner experience of charge around it. And that is going to allow anything you do to remedy a situation on the outside much more effective. So thank you for that question. And Deb?
We have someone in Florida that's got their hand raised.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hello? Yes. Hello, do you want to give us your name?
Hi, this is Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. I thought it was you.
I'm okay. I have a question on meditation and or this awareness of awareness that we're struggling to find. Could you tell me the connection between a meditative state that has depth, stillness, a shimmering quality, even maybe some sweetness, and awareness of awareness? Is one a stepping stone to the other? Are they identical? Are they connected at all?
Well, they're definitely connected. And, you know, the meditation has a number of bandwidths in it. You know, so it's like the way I like to think of it is that there are many, many rooms in awareness. You know, awareness contains everything. It contains luscious, sweet, juicy, you know, love experience. It contains a kind of bare, observer, witness experience. And they're all part of the great field of awareness. So just let it, let yourself not pick and choose among meditative states as to whether you feel like you're really meditating. I'll give you a clue if you're having a hard time finding awareness. Start by actually becoming aware of the feelings and sensations inside your body. In other words, do a basic mindfulness practice of bringing attention through the body, focusing on the forehead, seeing if you can go inside the head, feeling your way into the shoulders. Find the parts of your body that you can be conscious of, in other words. And as you notice attention and the way in which you can move attention around the body, then bring your attention outside the body to the space around you and become aware that your attention can also be experienced a foot outside the body, 3 feet outside the body. And as you practice with that, you may start to notice that you can kind of move back and forth between attention to the sensations in the body, attention to sounds, and then just a sense of the space around the body, what that feels like. You know, maybe bringing your awareness behind your head and sensing what that feels like. This will start to give you a felt sense of awareness itself. So I just suggest you try it. And for many people, attention, bringing attention inside the body kind of triggers sweetness. For other people, it's uncomfortable, especially if there's some physical discomfort there. But the point is to get your attention to be more fluid than it normally is. You know, most of us have a kind of a stiff quality about our attention. You know, but this, the awareness of awareness practice really is about recognizing that your capacity for attention is really very fluid. And it's not just the experience you have when you're highly focused on something. It's the very capacity to be present with whatever is here. So you might reframe the idea of awareness to, you know, you might call it presence.
It's kind of like, is it like the Vipassana meditation where it's just, you know, being focused on whatever is arising, constantly changing, just being aware of that?
Yeah, that is actually a good way to trigger this, you know, the experience of awareness. You know, in Vipassana meditators will start by doing these kind of mindful practices and then segue into just being open and present with whatever is. And as you sit in that, you do, and you will begin to become aware that which is able to be present to what is arising is actually what we are calling awareness. In other words, it's
almost like I'm good with the sensing. I could do all that. It's that last step I don't quite get.
Yeah.
You know, the being aware of all that.
Maybe
I don't practice enough of the basic awareness that you're talking about. You know,
I think it would be helpful if you do. I also would say that a lot of the problem that we have when in awareness of awareness is that we don't really recognize what we already know. You know, for instance, I had an experience about 20 years ago when I was feeling like I didn't understand what God is or what awareness is. You know, it was another version of the question you're asking. So I was sitting in meditation, and I actually prayed. You know, you have these moments when it feels as though you're enough in touch with divine help so that you can pray and it'll be answered. So it was one of those moments, and I prayed, I'd like to know how to experience God in this moment. And what happened was that I became aware of what I have always identified as the presence of Shakti, as the felt, energetic, formless substance that at that time in my life and still was very much a presence that I had been aware of ever since I first met my teacher, actually, because he kind of kindled it for me. And I got in that moment that this experience of a, you know, kind of somewhat sensual, very vibratory, very subtle presence was and is God. You know, God in its Shakti form. There are, you know, many other ways in which we can experience what people call God. But what I got was that I had been so taking for granted that experience of presence that it would never have occurred to me to realize that I was having a, you know, daily moment-to-moment experience of the divine. I'm just not knowing that's what it was. So I have a feeling
not claiming it.
Not claiming it, exactly. Not claiming it, not naming it. So, you know, just try asking, try praying, you know, show me awareness and then notice what comes up. Because, again, in my experience, your imagination, your will, your intention, as it is for everyone in this Sangham, has been cooked to the point where you can ask for knowledge and it will be there for you. You just have to recognize it.
Mm.
So thank you.
That's very touching. Thank you, Sally.
Oh, thank you. Was there someone in Oregon who wanted to speak, or is that just that I'm misreading my?
They just raised their hand. I just opened the line. Go ahead.
Okay.
Hi, Sally. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
So this is
How are you? I'm good.
You know, I'm actually like just basking in the rays of grace in these last days. I know it feels sort of like a miracle or a hallucination. Or like
why do we think that miracles are hallucinations? It's
I mean, because there's something so that's like such a departure, right?
Yeah, I know.
That I couldn't have done anything to make it happen, and I couldn't know how to make it happen again. And then I read Vicky's note today about that sort of issue of belonging or that knife that cuts into you. Like when you sort of have this and then suddenly you don't have it, you know?
Right.
And you know, and I think that the action is the same. It's like it's real easy for me to blame myself or like, whatever, do some kind of weird thing about my self-reflection in the falling. And also to not take any credit for it at all in the rising. So that's like the classic human conundrum. Like it gets better and it must be grace. And it's worse and it's got to be me.
Must be me.
I feel like I'm coming to a place where I feel like none of it is me, you know, and it's all happening through me. But, you know, to speak to Vicky's question today, and that's what I'm really hoping, if you could just talk about, like, how you use this practice in those spaces of despair. I mean, I think partly that praying, like actually asking for something is kind of a big piece. But, you know, I mean, and I know that when I just can't live, I just like turn on a mantra and just like the goddess chant or something. But I don't know if there's anything that you would say or how you approach these spaces when you come to them where like you literally are separated from however many days of grace you have, and, you know, how to come back.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few things that come up in your question. One is just to recognize that when you start to have the recognition, there is no me, and you know you're not dissociated. You know you're not having a psychotic episode. What do you call it? What do they call it? Depersonalization. To recognize that this is actually the truth. There is no you, right? That is to say, of course, there is a you. I mean, there is the Wendy personality, the Wendy body, all of this. and it's real at the level at which it's real. But, you know, at a certain point, you begin to recognize that this is the, you know, that your body, mind, personality is the outer shell that, and which is covering Shakti, who is actually playing as your life. So if you look at it that way, then, you know, then from an utterly, absolutely non-dual point of view, which is not a space that we can always be in, but from an utterly, absolutely non-dual point of view, it's all just the play of Shakti, you know, the ups and downs. Alice has been writing these posts about the Ulaya, another word for it is chinchala, the fluctuations of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So things are always expanding and contracting, and that's how it is. So, you know, if you can be a witness to the expansion and contraction, including, you know, how you get caught in certain aspects of it, that's great. And, you know, if you want to pray, I have always found that what is, I mean, I do, as I've often said, I pray for everything, including I pray for parking spaces. So I have no quarrels with anybody, you know, praying for your bad state to dissolve. I think it's completely acceptable, and I would say God, Goddess is fine with that. So it's not like there's anything wrong with it. But it is also, as I think you know, most effective to pray to be transformed, to pray to be given strength, to pray to be given understanding. In other words, to pray for resources, inner resources to handle whatever's coming up, and you have them, you know. So what happens when we pray like this is that she reveals to us that the capacities that we have temporarily lost touch with. I want to say one thing which I've been thinking about all day, and it's something that one of my teachers, Gurumai, said to somebody, which quite shocked me at the time. He had just gone through a really difficult tragedy, and he hadn't been around. He hadn't seen Gurumai in a while, so he came to see her, and they met, and he was telling her how awful everything was, and she said to him, "Why do you forget the truth in the midst of your pain?" And I was like, "Oh my God, that is so uncompassionate. You know, that is such an unsympathetic thing to say." What he told me afterwards was that when she said that, and she is one of those teachers who can sort of turn you around with a word. She has that particular siddhi. He went, "Oh my God, yes. There's actually been lots of help and support, you know," and his mind turned to all the ways in which he'd been supported through it. I love that story because what it always points to me, is the way in which the resources are there, but because of our habits of mind and because emotions in tragedy and grief and loss can be so overwhelming, we forget to look there. So, you know, once we start to look there, you know, to look at the support, to look at the resources, then things do start to change, and sometimes very slowly, sometimes very dramatically. But in a way, we're just walking, we're allowing consciousness to show us the beauty that we have inside, the love that we have inside, the grace that surrounds us, and the love that other people have for us, that the trees have for us, that the sky has for us. You know, so I'm very happy that you're in a state of grace. I hope it lasts forever. And I think we all know that, you know, grace comes, you know, the feeling of happiness comes and goes. But as I think you're discovering, there's something that's there, that's always there. And we may not be able to rest in it at particular times, but it is always there. So yeah.
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 Yeah, I really appreciate that, Sally. And and that's what I'm saying. It's like that idea of the knife that kind of cuts that space.
I think is just so true, because really, like, on either side, you know, like when you're in that lovely state of grace where it suddenly, you know, you're awake, you see it, you know, there's like, it seems like there's nothing that could happen that takes you out of that. And in the same way, when you're in that deep despair, literally there's no way that anything can come into it. And so it's like, I want to be prepared to, like, lose it all again, you know, and feel like I have this. But I guess I was sort of wishing you had some secret tool that, like, cuts between the spaces, but I don't know that there is any.
Well, there is.
Just the practice, right?
Yeah. Well, I also would say that having been through such an intense, tragic experience and such a long period of grieving, and having seen that there's light on the other side of the tunnel, you know that now. So when, you know, when difficult inner states arise, just knowing that they'll come to an end is in and of itself incredibly powerful and supportive. And we don't learn that except by going through really tough stuff and coming out the other side. Then you have confidence. I mean, if you think of what it was like when you were 15, you know, and something, you know, your friends, your best friend stopped speaking to you, or you didn't get into the school you wanted to go to, or whatever, you know, the horrible thing is, or you lost someone very close to you, you know, in a more final way, and you just do not believe you'll ever recover, and you do, you know, so and it just helps to know you can.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we mature.
I didn't mean to say just the practice, because honestly, the practice is everything. It's not just.
The practice is everything.
It's everything.
No, I know. You didn't mean just. You meant push comes to shove. The practice is what helps. Mm-hmm. I know. I understand.
All there is.
Yeah, the practice is our resource. It's our helper. It's our doorway. It's the gift we've been given that makes the most difference. So,
Well, thank you so deeply.
You are so welcome, darling.
I can't even express how much your instructions have allowed me to survive this. So, and my family too. And, you know, when I hear from Jen and, you know, and what she's going through and the grace she has to experience it, it's like such a gift to witness that too, you know?
Yeah, I know. It really is. It really is.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Sally. Yeah.
You're so welcome, and thank you. So, Deb,
I have one more question, which I think, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Okay, it's from Lauren. He asks, what advice can you give to the men in the Sangha? I love the goddesses, yet there must be more other than Shiva. It feels like a women's club at times. What do you say?
Yes, I know. I know. And sometimes the whole yoga world feels like a women's club. So, there are other male deities. Of course, what you're getting when you study with me is my own connection to certain deities, and the masculine deity that I have the strongest connection to is Shiva. But a lot of people that I know connect very strongly to Hanuman, connect very strongly to Ganesha, and there's all, you know, and you know, sometimes the figure of Krishna or Vishnu can feel, I don't know, not quite masculine enough for some people. But, you know, Krishna is a profoundly large divine form. In other words, Krishna is, I would say, how can I say this? He's both masculine and feminine. He carries all the powers of the masculine as well as the powers of the feminine. He's a lover, but he's also a warrior, a statesman, a strategist. A guru, of course. Sorry about that. I actually have taught a bit about Krishna and masculine deity. So I guess my suggestion to you, if you feel like this is a woman's club, is not to be intimidated by all the estrogenic shakti, which I know happens to guys, as it happens to women in circumstances in which the main discourse is in men's voices. So I think what we have to do is get rid of our gender shyness and just speak up, and hopefully we'll all support you. So I hope that helps, Lauren. And I just want you to know we all love your voice on the listserv and in these dialogues. But just consider, Lakshmi is the feminine form of Krishna, basically. So that luscious shakti has its masculine quality in him. Hanuman is a huge source of inspiration for strength and groundedness and yogic powers, devotion. Ganesha is probably the smartest deity that ever existed. You know, and I think one of the reasons, to be honest, why I emphasize goddess so much is because I do feel the world has not known the depth of the feminine, of the divine feminine, in the way that we have known the depth of the divine masculine. So I kind of stand up for goddess. It seems to be part of my work and my practice, but it's not because I in any way fail to recognize the profundity of the masculine archetypes. I hope that helps. I think that at this moment, we probably should bring this call to an end because we're 15 minutes over, and I know some of you want to have dinner or go to bed. So unless there's another question that feels really gripping and like you need to ask it, I think we should can say goodbye, and we'll meet up again tomorrow evening. So thank you so much. Thank you for this. I love the conversational quality of these Q&A sessions, and I'm glad that we got to do two of them. And I, again, love you all, and see you very soon. Thank you so much. Namaste. Have a great evening.